This land is yours, this land is mine, from California to New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream water, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio Show. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night from 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our website, thepeoplespeakradio.com. There you can also listen to live shows or to past shows on our iPod Ready archive section. That's thepeoplespeakradio.com. And if you have a Nokia phone, you can also listen live via satellite. Just go to the website for details. I have a wonderful guest, and it is a privilege for me as a Palestinian-American to have Dr. Clovis Maksoud, who is presently the Professor of International Relations at and Director of the Center of Global South of at American University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Maksoud is a lawyer, a journalist, and a diplomat. He served as the Arab League ambassador to India and Southeast Asia during the beginning of the 60s, and Dr. Maksoud is also a well-renowned author of several articles and books on the Middle East and the Global South, among them The Meaning of Non-Alignment, The Crisis of the Arab Left, and Reflections on Afro-Asianism and the Arab Image. Hello, Dr. Maksoud. It's wonderful to have you with us this evening.
Thank you very much, Hoka.
Well, you know, I knew a good friend of yours, Hanna Ajloni and his wife, Hala.
Yes.
And Hala says to say hello.
Thank you very much, yes. She's a wonderful person. She's now editing the Ramallah newspaper, magazine.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is the head of the Ramallah magazine. We're very proud of the work that Hala does for the community. Dr. Maksoud, you know, wow, where does one begin when we talk about the issues of the Middle East anymore? You know, there was a time when I suppose we could pick and choose from an array of or a platter full of areas that may have had some problems, but now it seems that it's an explosive situation. Where does one even begin in concern for what's happening in the Middle East today?
Well, first of all, I don't like the term Middle East because it's a remnant and a relic of the former colonial period where everybody was east of Europe, either Far East or Middle East or Near East. So we have an identity which is the Arab national patrimony. And therefore, the area itself at this moment is so fragmented and divided, partly because of historical reasons, but partly because of the situation that the challenges that we face in terms of human development and in terms of the continued endemic Arab-Israeli conflict, and particularly at this moment with the Palestinian division, which is supposed to be a red line that has been crossed, and hopefully the Arab world can restore it. Let us hope that the Arab summit, which is taking place in Tripoli next month, would at least minimize the damages if it cannot achieve what the Palestinian people deserve, namely the right of self-determination and the right of return and the national identity being come to fruition in an independent and sovereign state.
You know, we all agree as Arabs, and I absolutely agree with you, that it is a remnant of the colonialism. Somebody, you know, often we use the term Middle East because I think people are comfortable with that. But the truth is, I even ask, what are we the middle of? We don't even know what the middle of
That's right.
is. Middle, we're just the middle of the Middle East.
Hello?
And as Arabs throughout the region, the majority of us agree on certain conditions that must exist in order for peace to come to fruition in the area. Peace with justice, obviously. We have a concern between the reconciliation as Palestinians between Fatah and Hamas, and the current role of Mahmoud Abbas and his impact on the process. Can you reflect on any of those things for us, Dr. Maqsood?
Well, I mean, the nature of what is happening at this moment is, and since 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, Israel, the international community, and as you know, I was the ambassador of the Arab League at the United Nations, and at that time, Netanyahu was also the ambassador. We more or less coexisted, if you like, for 4 years debating the issue. Now, Israel does not acknowledge that it is an occupying power in the occupied territories, and therefore it is not subject to the Fourth Geneva Convention, which it should be. The international community has acknowledged and recognized and resolves that Israel in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem after 1967 is an occupying power. However, Israel, since 1967, does not acknowledge or recognize that it has the obligations and the responsibilities of an occupying power. Therefore, what is the status of Israel from the Israeli point of view in the occupied territories? The fact that it has proliferated settlements, the fact that it's Judaizing Israel gradually, incrementally, the fact that it has kept a sort of domination on the destiny and people of the whole entire occupied territories means that it is not an occupying power in its own definition of its own presence in the area. It is, in a way, acting as a claimant to the area. And that is why when, for example, President Obama, who thought that he was making a gesture of goodwill towards the Palestinians, said that the government of Israel should freeze settlements. Freezing settlements is not a starting point for a genuine and authentic and productive peace process. You don't freeze settlements. You dismantle settlements because they're illegal. And therefore, what happened is that we are still running around the issues. And Senator Mitchell, who is a good negotiator, but unfortunately, the fact that the United States, with its close relationship with Israel, cannot extract from Israel an acknowledgement that it is an occupying power. And therefore, when you find that people like Netanyahu or other officials in Israel saying that they are willing to make painful concessions. You concede what you own, not what you occupy. What you occupy, you comply with the resolutions of the United Nations, with international law, and with the Geneva Convention in particular. And therefore, the settlements, whether frozen or otherwise, is a projection of ownership or claim to ownership. And then the notion of two-state systems is becoming a sort of a mythology, because when Netanyahu mentioned in Abba and Ilan in the university that he slipped of the tongue maybe, but said two states, yes, he accepts that, but the conditions that he put has denied the Palestinians all the attributes of sovereignty, of independence, and of territorial coherence. And I think that what is happening is that they split because of this abstraction that they don't acknowledge that they are an occupier. What happened is that the Oslo Agreement produced a multiplicity of alternatives, elections, and therefore competing among the Palestinians, which is okay on a municipal level, but not on a national level where the resistance should remain. And resistance does not mean necessarily the military option. It is the last resort. The Intifada at the beginning was a manifestation of genuine resistance. The fact that you can be civil disobedience, you can demonstrate, you can go to the United Nations, these are all manifestations of peaceful projections of genuine resistance. But on the other hand, if all these options are exhausted and become an exercise in futility, then a militant resistance is legitimate by international law. And therefore, what we are faced is that as a result of this competitiveness and as a result particularly of what took place in the so-called roadmap, is that the resistance was overtaken by training Palestinian youth in Jordan to be police of the Palestinian Authority, to the extent that, in a way, you rubbed the resistance of its teeth. And as a result of that, what we have is no resistance anymore in the real sense of the word, no strategic resistance, whether in the West Bank or in Gaza. In Gaza, it became a sort of utilizing the anger to revenge rather than resist in the real sense of the word. And therefore, what is necessary is to reconstruct the whole notion of the Palestinian constituency into formulating the PLO as the vanguard of resistance, peaceful resistance, using all the nonviolent means as much as possible, but not dropping, as Mr. Abu Mazen did, dropping the militant option.
I absolutely agree with that. You know, but this brings me back to something that you said earlier, and it's something, Dr. Maksud, that I have always thought. I consider Israel to be a loophole society that lives in this land of limbo based on loopholes in national and international law, as well as the Geneva Convention rules of conduct. When we talk about, the first thing that you said was, Israel does not consider itself an occupier and has not conceded to being an occupier, therefore stands outside of the law, stands outside of the Geneva Convention.
That's right.
Must be made to concede. How do we make a loophole society that bases its entire, I mean, look at its non-proliferation agreement. It won't even admit that it has nuclear power, because once it admits it, it has to conform to the regulations of the nations and adhere to the policies of nuclear power, and it refuses to do that. So how is the loophole that it uses is by not admitting that it has it. And this is the same situation, not admitting that it's an occupied land, it's a disputed land, is another loophole. How do we get international law to mandate that adherence to that?
Well, international law has to be enforceable. And as long as which is the international instrument that is endowed with the capacity to enforce international law?
None.
And that is Security Council. And the Security Council, under Chapter 7, has the right to enforce. But since this authority was bestowed upon the international law, and since the Arabs and Palestinians have resorted to that, they have always come into contradiction with the possible threat of a veto by the United States in particular, about any time a sanction could be, or a penalty to deter Israel from continued expansion, continued creeping annexations that it has done since 1947. And therefore, the important thing also, let me be very frank also, is that the Arabs assume a responsibility in this sense, particularly that the Egyptian peace treaty with Israel has removed a major factor of deterring Israel and more or less gave Israel the license to obstruct the rights of the Palestinian people and dilute them, and as if the right of the Palestinians to their national and human rights is a concession to be achieved rather than a right to be accomplished. And thus, and to that extent, it is necessary that the Arabs as a whole should rethink, because as long as Israel is capable of assuming the direction of Middle East politics as it tries to do, and with the imbalance of power and with the fact that it doesn't comply to the non-proliferation treaty, the NPT, all these factors keeps the status quo in the Arab world unmovable, because in a way the Palestinian question, I mean, there are many other problems in Iraq, in Yemen, in Darfur, everywhere. These are serious problems. They undermine the credibility of the Arabs to a very large extent. Yet the Israeli question, the Israeli-Palestinian question, encapsulates the Arab sense of humiliation. And that is why it remains a pivotal and primary issue for the Arab world and for many other parts of the world.
Yes, it absolutely doesn't. It's, you know, it shows that there are people. You know, if the legislators of law and the Security Council can't mandate a law, then what good is the law? And then we go back to our societal ethics and mores. Are we either are human beings that believe in law and the justice that law can help create in our nations? Or we do not believe in law, and we are barbarians at this level. I think some of us are barbarians. Let me ask you, I know we've lost a lot of Palestinian intellectuals in 2009, Anis al-Sayer, Shafiq al-Hout, Kamel Najji. You know, there are a lot of these intellectuals and people that have fought and struggled for peace and justice for the Palestinian people in Lebanon and in the areas. Are we doomed and destined to watch generation after generation pass away with no solution or resolution to any of these problems, Director?
Well, I mean, there is no doubt that many of these people, from Fayez Sayer to Hisham Sharabi to Edward Said, I mean, these people were the conscience of the Arab world. I mean, not only of the Palestinian people. And you had people like Kamal Nasser, like many people who have struggled in the intellectual field, in the literary field, and have achieved and have contributed to the awakening of the international conscience, to the morality and to the justice of the Palestinian cause. However, unfortunately, they were not sufficiently consulted by the decision makers in the Palestinian movement to a very large extent, and therefore their input was not factored in a manner to create the Palestinian unity and the strategic thinking of how to resist and confront the Israelis' creeping annexation and defiance of international law, and other words. The important thing is, and I sort of get a little bit angry at ourselves, is that we have not done enough in the United States, especially the Arab American community, not because they didn't want to, but because the many in the Arab American community were not able to do a counter pressure to the important, to the very strong Israeli lobby. And therefore, Israel has, to a large extent, proliferated words that have become associated with the Palestinian movement, and especially now, words that associate as if Palestine is an interruption in international relations, rather than a core issue that has to be addressed in order to resolve many other problems that emerge out of the humiliation that the Palestinian people and the Arabs suffer. And that is why the violence that is spreading out, that Palestinian issue is being used by all sorts of people who want to settle accounts with the West or with others, while the biases that the West, not all the West, but in many ways, the biases that are inherent in the policies that are practiced towards the Palestinian movement is that the Palestinians are secondary rather than a central issue in the regional problems that are taking place. And on the other hand, also, that the fragmentation of the Arabs, the fact that Arab nationalism suffered major setbacks, that has to restore itself, because there is no possibility to deter and Israel's aggression against the Palestinians and against the Lebanese and the threats against Syria and the utilization of what its role through the neoconservatives here in Iraq. All these issues means that there must be a restoration of a sort of a Arab consensus concerning the fact that there must be Palestinian national unity, that there must be emphasis on Jerusalem being the capital of Palestine, on the right of return, and that they cannot have that the intelligence operation in the intelligence mechanism in Egypt, which has normal relations with Israel, to be in charge of the musalaha, of the peace between the factions of the Palestinian people. That means that this issue of Palestine that has encapsulated all our emotions, our literature, our poetry, our politics, our whole existence, our sense of dignity, all that is now being managed by an intelligence operation. Of course, intelligence should be part of the security issues, but it can't be the one that guides and the sole one that guides the destiny of the Palestinian people.
You know, you wrote once, Arabs and Muslims do not hate. However, Arabs and Muslims are angry. We must recognize the important distinction between anger and hate.
Well, and that was said on the TV by me immediately after the September 11th. And when the terrorist act took place in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania, what I said at that time, that when President Bush and others were asking, why do Arabs and Muslims hate us? Well, Arabs and Muslims do not hate. There are a few aberration of people who hate. Arabs and Muslims are angry at the injustice that has been inflicted, particularly by the in Palestine. They're angry. But anger is an invitation to dialogue, an invitation to negotiate, an invitation to persuade. Therefore, anger is a healthy position which should be welcomed by the Americans and by others. It's not an anger that hates. Hate is a negation of anger. It is the contradiction of anger. Hate consumes dialogue, while anger invites dialogue. And that is what I tried to say, and I think I still would say it. And I think there should be an Arab narrative that is coherent, that is convincing, and we have the elements of morality and justice and interest to have a coherent narrative to persuade the United States to be much more objective in its approach. And we all thought at one time that President Obama would be the recipient of a coherent narrative, and I still think he will be, but unfortunately, the dispersal or the fragmentation of the Arab narrative as radicals and moderates and all that, and especially the fragmentation within the Palestinian, among the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza and others. Today, I think that we have to restore the coherence and the consistency and the persuading capacity of the Palestinian narrative, which was so elegant and enlightening even after 1967. Even after 1967, the conscience of the world was with us, with the Palestinian cause. At this moment, the people who are supportive of the Palestinians are a little bit confused about which Palestinian faction they want to support, which thesis they want to support.
And that is why it is necessary that we all come together on that. Unfortunately, a lot of Palestinians are confused. I have a question for you, Dr. Maksud, and this is directly asked from a stringent advocate of your words. This man loves you. And he asked if you would please elaborate or explain a statement that you made in El Ahram. And it goes, in order to activate the initiative, Maksud suggested that Arab diplomacy should try to persuade UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to drop out of the quartet in order for the UN to help the Palestinians recapture their rights. How can the UN be part of the quartet which boycotted a dramatically elected Palestinian government early last year, he questioned. Can you
I think that the Secretary General of the United Nations, whether it's Ban Ki-moon or the ones before, I think they should withdraw from the the quartet. I mean, the United Nations Secretariat General is the point of reference. We come to it. It cannot be part of a small group where the United States, France, and Russia are. We are the European Union. What about our close friends all over the world? What about South Africa? What about China? What about Japan? What about others? I mean, Secretary General has to be the articulate exponent of international law, international resolutions. And therefore, by being co-opted, he is ratifying only a sector of the international community. That is why I objected, and I still object to the fact. And on the other hand, the quartet has proven totally irrelevant. And on the other hand, to have the quartet have Mr. Blair, who continued to lie about his role in the Iraqi situation, and he's in a state of total denial of his role, and proud that he was a partner in the illegal war on Iraq, all that, and now he's a representing of the quartet in the Palestinian issue. I think that is unacceptable and should be unacceptable.
Well, I agree. Again, I agree. But I am a little bit leaning on the left in even the Palestinian issues, as I know you are. We have a question from Mike in California, and he asked, is Obama an agent of hope and change regarding Israel and the Middle East, or is he simply a continuation of the Bush and the American doctrine of imperialism, colonialism, and support of Israeli apartheid?
I don't think he's either both, neither of them. He's not any longer I mean, he's not the continuation of the imperial. I think his whole brought up, his whole tradition, his whole historical evolution will maintain a level of not falling into that trap. But on the other hand, he has inherited a policy and a tradition that has made it difficult for him, although he tried to make certain signs of being hopeful on resolving that question. Yet I think that unless he can extract from Israel an acknowledgement that it is an occupying power and not a disputed presence or a claimant as it behaves, I think that the United States will not be able to break through the wall, not only the real walls that it has, that Israel has established, but the wall of obstruction that lies with Israel's attitude towards the Arab world and particularly towards the Palestinians. So I would not, on this issue, I cannot categorize President Obama in that framework, but on the other hand, the expectations that might have been exaggerated that he can break through and bring about a just solution to the Palestinian issue.
Dr. Maksoud, I'd like to bring up something that I know has been has brought about some concern for a lot of Palestinians, not only Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, but also in diaspora. There's a talk of creating an immigration department, and many feel that if this happens, the designation of many of the refugees would be changed to immigrants, making it even harder in the area of the right of return. How do you feel about that, and how do you feel about the right of return? How stringent do you think that we should apply ourselves to that?
Well, this is a very central issue. It has very many ramifications, and when you put it in a framework that Israel and its Zionist ideology acts on the right of return of the law of return for any Jew to come to Israel, and almost in the recent 5 years, more than a million and a half have immigrated and have established settlements in many parts of the West Bank. I think that law of return is an attempt to deny the right of return of the Palestinian refugees. And here you have a situation of contrast, that the law of return of Jews to Israel in an expanding and a creeping annexation process is denying the right of the return of the Palestinian refugees enshrined in UN resolutions and international law. And it is an amazing double standard that when the Albanians of Kosovo had the right to return to immediately after the conflict, the right of the return of the Palestinians is trying to be accommodated by the dispersal of Palestinian refugees in the various camps. And that goes to show how deficient our collective Arab diplomacy is and our communication system is. And I think that it is important that we restore these fundamental rights as the core of collective Arab diplomacy. And I don't see, I mean, I don't want to be pessimistic, but I cannot say I'm at this moment optimistic. I would, with many others, I think what many others are beginning to realize, that we have to keep on telling what we really think, telling what we think is the truth, what is the rights of the Palestinians and of the Arabs in human development. I mean, we are a rich nation of poor people. We must not forget that. And that is one of our vulnerabilities as a collective Arab nation.
Very true. Very true. And your thoughts on creating a Department of Immigration within Palestine?
Well, I mean, there are certain, if it is done on individual basis, that is okay. But if it's done as a collective, in order to resolve the problems of Palestinians, the one way of resolving the problem of refugees, one way, I mean, not the whole way, but one way, is that let them have a viable Palestinian, coherent, consistent state with a capital in East Jerusalem, if we want to go into the so-called realistic formulations that are current now, then that sovereign state can bestow upon many refugees the Palestinian citizenship. So they can, for a while, remain as Palestinian citizens, residents of Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, until the right of return is negotiated at a later stage. But to deny them the state, a sovereign Palestinian state that can provide them the right of citizenship, of a Palestinian citizenship, on the one hand, and to deny the right of return is compounding the issue of Palestinian injustice.
Well, that's for sure. We have a question from Rita in Wisconsin, Dr. Maksud, and Rita asks, why does the U.S. government support the apartheid of Israel, and why do the American people not oppose it?
Well, I mean, the former president of the United States mentioned, President Carter mentioned the fact that what is being practiced is a form of apartheid in the Palestinian issue. He was almost, called anti-Semitic. I mean, Israel has established a system of intellectual and political terrorism. If you criticize it, you are anti-Semitic, or you are a Islamic fundamentalist, or you are an Arab bigot, or whatever. I mean, and unfortunately, this has to be confronted in the United States, in the battle of information, and this must be organized. And instead of having the Arab American community divided and being the mirror of the divisions among the Arab states, it should be, on the contrary, the yeast of Arab unity, so that it has effect, it has impact, and it can persuade. And on the other hand, the impunity of Israel has to be deterred and penalized. I mean, when Gaza was taking place, I advocated that Egypt and Jordan should suspend and break relations with Israel so that the impunity is deterred. I mean, there must be a cost for the aggression, the annexation, the creeping annexation, and really the Holocaust in installments that Israel inflicted upon the people of Gaza.
Well, I absolutely agree. And again, they do what they do with impunity. We have a guest on the line, Dr. Maksud, Bobby from Fresno, California. Bobby, do you have a question for Dr. Maksud?
I can't hear.
Bobby? I guess he's lost connection. We do have a question that is pending, and the question is, what is the current status and the legalities and the state of the apartheid wall being built today?
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
Oh, okay. What is the current status of the apartheid wall being built as far as legalities and what's being done and what is not being done?
Well, I mean, the International Court of Justice, unanimously, with the exception of one judge who voted against it, but had certain reservations. It was almost a unanimous decision that this was totally illegal because it is an infringement in an occupied territory. I mean, the International Court of Justice recognizes that the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem are occupied. But Israel, because of its claim, it can establish whatever it wants. I mean, the wall is in the same illegal category as the settlements are in the category, in illegal. So, and the Judaization that is taking place only today in Salwan, they destroyed so many houses despite the fact that the court has said you cannot destroy them. They destroyed them anyhow. And so what we have is that this has to be removed because it is another projection of claim and not a projection of an occupier. An occupier can never, under any circumstances, cannot, under the Geneva Convention and under international law, cannot alter the geographic or the demographic character of the occupied territories. You cannot establish new settlers. You cannot establish your citizens as permanent in the area which you occupy. You cannot establish new walls. You cannot establish annexation. All these are being done with impunity, and the Palestinian leadership is divided, and that is not acceptable.
And that brings us back to step one, Dr. Maksoud. Although we know that they are doing these illegal actions with impunity, we have no one that can enforce the law, or they can enforce the law and they have chosen not to for various reasons. And so Israel is just growing and growing and growing and stealing more and more and more.
Well,
How do we stop it?
Well, I mean, when I had my birthday, they celebrated my birthday in the Arab League in Cairo a month ago. I said, the League of Arab States at this juncture should not be the League of Arab Governments only. I am deferential to the governments, but it should be the League of Arab People, the Arab Societies. And I think that what is happening is that simultaneously, as long as we do not have a penalty to the impunity of Israel, then there is not going to be any movement in the direction of correcting the imbalance of the balance of power. I think that if after Gaza or during Gaza, Egypt broke its relationship with Israel, I think that Israel might have been shaken. It has to pay a cost, and that is a cost that it has not paid because of the premature normalization that Arab states have made with Israel.
This brings us to our next guest's question. Steve in the United Kingdom says, does the Arab League include Jordan and Egypt, which I consider extensions of U.S. terrorism? So we aren't the only ones. There are people all over the world that consider Jordan and Egypt to be complicit in the terrorism against the Palestinians in the territories by the United States and its and Israel, and they are just an extension of that.
Well, we must distinguish. I mean, the people of Egypt and the people of Palestine, to a very large extent, denounce completely the premature peace treaties, if you want to call it premature. What I'm saying, I think what I said and what is being said is that they should cut relations so that Israel realizes that it cannot have a total license to do whatever it wants in the Palestinian. And on the other hand, it is important also that the peace, the unity, the national unity of the Palestinians must be restored. And I hope, people who have fallen into the trap of Oslo and the leadership should revise the fact and not have their people trained in Jordan by the American and Jordanian officers as policemen, which suppresses demonstrations of the Palestinians rather than be a part and parcel of the culture of resistance.
May I ask you what your thoughts on are on Doctor on the Egyptian reconciliation document?
Well, I think there, I read it. I mean, I know I read it quite often, and I wrote about it in Egyptian papers. There is no word called resistance. There is not a word in the whole thing called resistance. It is all security, the security of this, security of that. No word. No, the word resistance doesn't appear. And therefore, I mean, if Palestinians under occupation do not have the option of legitimate resistance, which is enshrined by the Charter of the United Nations, then how do we deal with it? How do we achieve the rights? So, and therefore, I want the restoration of a genuine reconciliation between the various factions, but I want, in a way, that this reconciliation produces a revised leadership. I don't want to say
well,
new leadership, but a revised leadership.
According to Hassan Zaki, his statement Hassan Zaki, he's the Egyptian foreign minister. He says the document is now ready for signing. Each Palestinian faction needs to make a historic decision and sign it. Zaki added that this is in the best interest of the Palestinian people. How can a document by what we consider now an alien government that actually perpetuates the occupation against the Palestinians determine that Palestinians are to sign a document that, as you say, doesn't even include the terminology of resistance?
Well, I mean, the document doesn't mention resistance, but it doesn't say there is no... resistance has to be self-generated. And resistance is a product of... It's a culture. It's a culture that seeks equality, that seeks human dignity, that seeks human freedom. It's a culture, and it doesn't have to be violent, but militancy is the option of last resort. And therefore, the culture of revenge does not exist in the strategy of resistance. The culture of the basic cultural and moral justification for resistance is that resistance liberates the people under occupation and liberates the occupier from the dehumanization that occupation has inflicted upon the people who are occupiers. That is the ennobling, the high moral position of the need for resistance when there is occupation and there is claim against the right of the Palestinian people to be free and independent and having their own identity. So resistance is a culture, is a culture at a time of achieving liberation. And that when
and
liberation is achieved, there's no more need for
an
resistance.
Honorable one.
Sorry?
And we consider it an honorable one as well.
Of course. Of course. I mean, Mandela was treated as a terrorist. He suffered for 27 years, and he came out. He did not go into revenge against the whites. He said, one person, one vote, and that's it.
No, I think it absolutely minimizes the struggle of the Palestinian people when people sit there and say that they're using this as revenge. This is not revenge. This is not about revenge.
No.
This is about survival. This is about survival,
not only survival.
Of one's own personhood, one's own culture, one's own heritage, one's history, everything that attaches a human being to society, to the human race, is at stake here.
Well,
and for us to minimize it and say that this is just about militancy, this is just about
vengeance.
It's a
basic
lie.
Culture, because it is trying to restore liberty when it's being systematically denied. The minute liberation takes place, finish. Then normalcy takes place. Because what happens when Israel does not admit that it's an occupying power, it treats any kind of resistance, it markets it as terrorism, but it really treats it as an insurrection against the state of Israel. That is, and therefore it can crush it. And that's what happened in Gaza. It didn't treat as a resistance that has to be, if you are an occupier, you can have certain rights and all that, but when you treat a resistance as an insurrection against your claim of Palestine, then naturally it's like a separatist movement. And it's like what happened to the Tamils when the Sri Lankans crushed them. And that's exactly what Israel treats them as. They claim, they market them as terrorists, because that is an easy way to market.
It is a definite marketing campaign. We have another question.
It's a marketing tool, but it's really a crush of an insurrection. And that's what explains, imagine that in the United States, in the Arab world, we did not use Goldstone's indictment of the war crimes that Israel pursued. Certain individuals and lawyers, yes, they did. But where is the campaign to bring to the forefront what Richard Falk did and what Goldstone did? And they're both, I mean, with due respect to everybody's religion, they're both convinced Jews, and they wanted to salvage their Jewish values from the dehumanization that Zionism tries to inflict. These are constituency of conscience, and therefore we ignore them. What is happening to the
Goldstone? Well, I absolutely love that, the constituency of conscience. And you know, this is what I've always said. I don't know that I will ever see peace in my country, Palestine.
I hope you will.
I sure hope I will, but if
don't
I
give
don't,
up.
I will never stop trying. It's as simple as that. And that is because I have a conscience, and as a constituent of consciousness in this world, I have to do what is right. It is in the interest of the human race to do what is right.
That's what we all have.
And we have one more question from a guest, Art in Iowa, Dr. Maksud, if we can fit it in real quickly, that asks, can Dr. Maksud give his opinion of George Galloway and groups like Viva Palestina and why the Arab League cannot pressure Egypt from harassing aid to Gaza? From harassing aid to Gaza, yes.
Well, I mean, the constituency of conscience has been facing the ruthlessness and the recklessness of those who are more permissive towards Israeli aggression than the constituency of conscience, that people who went to Gaza and tried to break through the walls that have been encircling Gaza, that goes to show that there is a residual constituency in the world that we have to keep it being the torchlight that guides our hopes amidst the disarray of our agony.
Well, I have to tell you, although I do have doubts, especially when I hear Netanyahu say the things that he says over and over again as if no one else is talking, I have my doubts that we are in an era of peace at this point. I believe we are entering an era of war. And but again, for those of you that are out there and who have a conscience and understand this constituency that must reign supreme, follow your conscience. Do what is right. What else would you be doing? Shopping? Dr. Maqsood, it has been an honor and a pleasure having you on our show this evening. I look forward to perhaps having you return at a later date. And is there anything you'd like to say before we close?
No, I just want to thank you very much. And I think that the important thing is to restore the equation. And I think in the United States, we must, the availability of many people who need to be mobilized on this issue to make sure that when Netanyahu says we want people to, we will welcome restoration of negotiations without any preconditions. Well, he establishes continuously, day after day, new facts, and he says, no, he
and
doesn't want any conditions. What kind of... There must be a clarity of the objective. You negotiate agreed upon result, and then you negotiate. There has been no negotiations since Oslo, and that is why we have to be very precise in our terms and words.
Absolutely. And as I said, as Americans, as people from the United Kingdom, from Australia, from Canada, listeners, apply the law. You know, people say, what's the solution? It's easy. Apply the law. It's really quite simple.
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Maqsood. And again, let the people speak. Thank you all very much for being with us this evening. We will see you next week. Thank you very much.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the big wall by the relief of the trap, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering how this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is mine, there, from California to New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.